So the date is the 3rd of July 2015. I'm here in 32 Lincoln's Inn with Jim Thomas. My name is Clara Manassian Cook, and we're here doing an LSE oral history interview for the 120th anniversary of LSE. Jim, please can you state your name and your date of birth?
Yes, my name is Jim Thomas, and my date of birth is 3rd December 1933.
And Jim, when did you first come to LSE?
I came here as an evening student in 1956. It was really a very lucky accident that I got here. My parents grew up in the Rhondda Valley, and both of them working class families, both of them left school at 14. So I had very little idea about higher education. And so when I got in a grammar school towards the sixth form level, I had to choose arts or science. They couldn't help me, and we didn't have much help at school at that time, and they thought if you took the arts side, you would end up being a teacher. And given what I thought of teachers at the time, that didn't seem like a very good idea. So I ended up going to the science side, taking physics, chemistry, pure and applied maths, and working towards going to university to do physics. It quickly became clear to me that I wasn't particularly interested in science, and so I managed to solve that problem by failing my maths on one and a half occasions. And when I went for an interview for doing a science degree, the only place that offered me an interview was University College London. I went along one Saturday morning and was interviewed. It was pretty clear I had no idea about physics, but I'd taken my laboratory lab book with the experiments in, and the young physicist took a look at it and said, well, you've got neat handwriting. Have you ever thought of being an accountant? Squelch. Anyway, I'd now reached a point where I had to go off and do national service, and I had 2 years in the Air Force. The maths came in handy there because that meant I could get into the Air Force as opposed to being put in the Army. And so I had 2 years in the Air Force. And towards the end of it, I didn't have any idea what I was going to do. But I had worked out a couple of strategies for avoiding work, one of which was to say, given you're all down a C of E, that you had to see the padre because you had lost your faith. And that meant you could go and have tea with the padre at least two or three times and avoid some work. The other strategy was to say you wanted to go and see the station education officer and you could spend a couple of hours there and avoid work. Well, I did that at this camp and came across a brochure for LSE. And that was the answer to a question. My last billet was, in fact, with a small group of people on a radar station. And one of them, well, the four of us, one of us just read comics all the time. The two others argued politics all the time. One was a Marxist, the other a Methodist. And I used to sit in with them and try and take part in the conversation, but I quickly discovered I knew nothing about history, politics, or economics. So then when I went to the education officer's office and picked up this brochure for LSE, looked at the courses, politics, economics, economic history, political history, I applied. And I was accepted and started in 1956 as an evening student. I did 2 years in the evenings working as a civil servant during the day. And so that routine over the 2 years was from Monday to Friday. I'd come up to LSE and between 6 and 8 or 6 and 9 have lectures, classes, and then Saturday and Sunday I'd spend the whole time reading and catching up on work. After 2 years of this, I began to wilt. I had three more to go as an evening student. And so I applied to the GLC and they gave me a small grant and paid the fees, which are very low in those days, and I got unpaid leave from the civil service. And so I suddenly switched from being an evening student to being a full-time student, which was bliss. Free time, time to read things, etc. So that's how I continued my degree, and I graduated with the BSc Econ special subject computational methods in June 1960.
What was your first impressions of the campus when you first arrived? Like, what did you first think of LSE?
I felt like coming on the night shift because we would be arriving, the 200 or so evening students, probably more actually, because of the 3 years. So about 400 or 500 evening students would be walking in the front door at 6 o'clock. And by now the day students had either gone home or they were in the three tons or doing other evening activities. And so it felt very strange. And I never got much sense of what LSE was like, except what it was like in the evenings. And I was never around here at the weekends. It was very much smaller then. There was the old building and the east building, and Houghton Street hadn't been closed at that point, so taxis used it as a shortcut, and there was a lot of noise with taxis zooming around the corners. And so it was a very limited impression of LSE altogether.
And what were the other evening students like?
They were quite widespread of different occupations, but probably the biggest group would have been teachers who had teaching qualifications but didn't have a degree and therefore wanted to get the degree so they could change their status in teaching. Apart from that, there were people from all over the place, some people just doing it out of interest, or they had to be really interested to spend 5 years on it, and others who were in different occupations where it would be helpful. Some, for example, might choose accounting and finance as the special subject, and then they could use that as part of professional qualifications.
And were they mostly mature students, or were they, a lot of them were?
They were all mature. Yes, they're all sort of 20s, 20-plus, and some in the 30s, even 40s.
Did you take part in any student groups or any political student groups while you were
Not here? As an evening student, but as a once I became a full-time student, I joined various clubs. I was in the Labour Society. I was in others, so I can't now remember what they were. Oh, I think I joined the sailing club, probably going up once to the place where they sailed, some quarry, I think it was. I never did any sailing, so I wasn't very active in societies.
And who were, like, your most memorable lecturers, your most memorable teachers?
In terms of the teaching, then, the lecturers, all of them were pretty good. The classes were absolutely shambolic in certain areas. In economics, they were hopeless. The teacher would come in and say, "What did you do in the last lecture?" Nobody could remember, so we'd look in our books and tell him, and he'd then say, "Any questions, hopefully?" And often they weren't, and so we'd go through an hour of miserable plodding along. Others were much better. Economic history and political history, for example, and politics, all had topics to be handed out for the students to prepare papers. And that meant at least there was structure. Although, I remember in economic history, I was in a group of accountants and economists who none of them were the least interested in economic history. And we'd be set a topic, and the speaker would gabble through it in about 10 minutes at a totally incomprehensible speed, leaving the poor teacher with about 45 minutes. So he would say, hopefully, any questions. Usually they weren't. So I had a couple of strategies. I knew he'd written on interest rates in England. So I'd say, well, what was the effect on interest rates in that time? And he'd breathe a big sigh of relief and then begin to talk about interest rates. And that would keep us going for the 45 minutes. At least we weren't sitting there in dire silence.
It seems quite directed by the students rather than by the lecturers themselves.
It was very much so in I specialised in maths and stats, and there you had weekly exercise sheets, so that was very structured. You do them, and then the teacher would go over them on the board, or we didn't have photocopying in those days, so it had to be all done on a blackboard with chalk.
What was graduating like? Did you have a graduation ceremony?
There was one. It was then, we were much more part of the University of London in those days. I mean, we still are technically, but now we're more or less completely independent. But then we were very much part of the University of London. And so instead of having the graduation at LSE, you all went down to the Albert Hall and took part with students from the same faculty in other institutions. So at that point, I didn't like the idea of dressing up in a mortarboard and gown, and so I simply forgot to remind my parents when it was. And only after the event did I say, oh, I think we forgot about it. So my graduation was just the tube that arrived in the post with this scroll saying I had the degree of BSc Econ.
And I see that you received the Alan Young Prize and the Raines
Undergraduate Prize. Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit more about those prizes and how did it feel winning them?
Surprised. The one thing was I had this bad record at A-levels, failing maths, and at the end, after, two and a half attempts, I only had marks in the 60s. So I didn't think I was that much good academically. And so when I switched from being an evening student into being among full-time day students, the one thing was they were much younger, so I'd done national service, so I was about 25. Most of them were 18, 19. And having come straight from school, they were much more gung-ho about doing exams. So I was quite nervous when I started to do exams and quite surprised when I did well. And I'm honest, I was working hard. I got into the routine of it from being an evening student. And though I didn't quite spend seven days a week on it, I didn't do all that much other than study, partly because I'd come in late, so most of the other students were all already had friends and linkages and commitments, and I was very much an outsider. They were very friendly, but I wasn't part of the group. And so I was quite surprised when I took part one and ended up getting these two prizes. One was for the best part one result, which really surprised me, and the other was, I think, for the best, the Alan Young, I think, was the best performance in economics. So quite a shock, but a very pleasant one. And then in part two, I was specialising in computational methods, which meant I was doing, in the final year, five exams, all of which were in maths and statistics. And then I did well again. So I managed, overall, I got a first-class honours, which, again, surprised me. I had no idea when I came to LSE that that was going to happen.
What was the demographic of the students like at that time? Were there more men than women? Were there lots of overseas students, or were there mostly British students?
The demographic varied, as probably still does, but certain departments were very much men. I think that was true in economics. Others were much more women. I think it was sociology, often had a majority of women, and others were somewhat more mixed. There were a much higher proportion of Brits, and we still, though, because of LSE's history and development, had more overseas students than other institutions, other than Oxford or Cambridge. The three of us had had that long tradition of attracting overseas students. And in 1979, jumping forward a bit, when Mrs. Thatcher introduced the change in funding, and now to survive, you suddenly had to attract overseas students. A lot of the new universities were in a complete panic because they had either none or so few overseas students, they didn't know what to do. Whereas for LSE, it was just a question of gearing up and, without dropping standards, finding new courses and attracting in new overseas students. And we did very well. We expanded very smoothly.
Because we already had that groundwork.
That's right. And already pretty good links. We had the general course program, which was a link with North America, and we had junior year abroad students coming from lots and lots of good North American universities. So with that, we simply expanded the number of universities, still with the top American places, and took in more, but without dropping standards. And that was the big thing about the expansion. We had to maintain standards, because LSE was a slum, you know, in the middle of London, and you couldn't attract students to the green open fields and all the facilities. They'd only come if they knew the standards were high. So whatever we did, it had to ensure no drop in standards, which did prevent us just, you know, throwing the doors open to anybody. It meant, again, we had to make very carefully that we didn't drop our standards.
And I understand that after studying here, you started working here.
Yes.
So when did you first start working at LSE?
Well, I took my final exams in the BSc Econ in June 1960, and I returned to LSE in September as an assistant lecturer in economics.
Was that your plan when you graduated, to return?
It was certainly my hope. I mean, I enjoyed being a student so much. As far as I see, being an academic is just like being a student, except you got paid for it. And so I was, you know, up for becoming an academic. Also, I got quite friendly with one or two of the junior people in the economics department. And the timing was very lucky for me, because under Lionel Robbins, there'd be no particular interest in mathematics or statistics, econometrics within the economics department. He was pretty skeptical about those particular techniques. And he was drawing towards the end of his time as the head of the department. And some of the younger people were, clearly they wanted to change the emphasis somewhat and bring in more development of mathematics and particularly econometrics. And I was very lucky that purely by chance in my final year, I was very friendly with some students in the economics department who specialised in economics. One of them ran the Student Economics Society. And because there was so little maths in the department, he got me to come in and give a paper to the students arguing the case for maths in economics. So I prepared a short thing and went along for this meeting, went into the room and had the shock of my life, because there was my friend Alan, there was another member of the undergraduate committee, and five members of the staff, including Bill Phillips, professor of economics. Anyway, I managed to stumble through my banal presentation to these guys, and you know, after about 10 minutes, I'd run out of steam. And then we had a very interesting discussion on their part about what they thought should happen. But the important thing in my point of view was I now made contact with Bill Phillips and a number of the others. And they began to say, well, what do you plan to do after you graduate? Had you thought about economics? And so I was being encouraged to apply, and that's what I did.
What was it like being on the other side of the classroom, like from going from being an actual student to very quickly being the actual lecturer?
Terrifying, to be honest, because, again, it's changed completely now. Now you have proper induction. It wouldn't happen anyway. I'm a dinosaur in the sense that you can't go now from being an undergraduate in statistics to being an assistant professor these days in economics. So my economics I'd done in the BSU Econ consisted of a one-year course in microeconomics, a one-year in macro, and some applied courses, which are mainly looking at charts and not really doing any economics. There was no induction. I simply got a letter from the administration saying that my office was going to be such and such. It was actually in King's Chambers, sharing with a statistician. So I moved into the office, moved in my three or four books, and started trying to read some economics. You know, it was about time, again, I was going to be teaching it. And then in week five, I think, some class registers arrived telling me which groups I would be teaching and their names. I never had a meeting with Lionel Robbins, the head of the department. None of the lecturers whose course I was teaching approached me. And so it was, you know, really hopeless. And so I went in and I struggled through for a few weeks. And it really was very, very difficult, because I was sometimes, if I was lucky, a whole chapter ahead of the students, and I could then answer the questions. Other times I was struggling. But the one thing I did discover was you couldn't flannel students. If you try to pretend, you could just see on their faces, they knew. And so it's much, you couldn't do it too often, it's much better to say, look, I honestly don't know, I'll tell you next time, than to pretend you knew and you couldn't explain it to them because they were too thick or whatever. But it was tough.
Yeah, so following on from that, did you find the students at LSE different than in other places that you've worked?
Well, I've only really taught at LSE on a full-time basis. I've gone elsewhere and taught short courses. I taught three summer session courses in at Columbia University in New York during the 1960s. So really, it's just students here. And I think they've changed over time. They I've become less, well, I retired from teaching in 2002, so I can't say what's happened since then in terms of teaching. I'm still around doing research, but not nothing to do with teaching. But over time, they became less docile, I think, and more questioning, which I thought was good. Because often, you know, they, students would come in and sit and want to take notes, even in a class, and it was very hard to get them to participate, particularly teaching a technical subject. You can't engage people by saying outrageous things and getting, you know, eventually, if you say something outrageous enough in politics, somebody will respond. But in maths and stats, you know, it's more difficult. But I enjoyed teaching, and I found trying to figure out dynamics in a class was quite interesting. You know, why somebody sat at the back and didn't say anything, etc. So, you know, they were interesting challenges in the teaching.
You also had other experiences at LSE that just weren't just teaching, but like a, from what I see, like administration experiences. So you were a tutor for a while, weren't you, I believe?
Yeah, I did a lot of admin. Started off being the economic department's representative on different committees. And then eventually, when I'd done enough committees, I was invited to become oh my goodness, I can't remember what it was. Excuse me.
Dean of Undergraduate
Studies.
Yeah.
Oh dear, senior moments are coming, I'm sure. And that was, I was still doing my full-time, well, almost my full-time teaching load, and that was a three-year appointment. And I think I was on nine different committees, chairing some of them, being on others. And that involved a lot of administrative work.
Did you enjoy that?
I did. Once I worked my way into it. Fortunately, we had a wonderful registrar called Rosemary Nixon, and she was totally unflappable and incredibly patient. And I found for the first 3-4 months at least, people would come in to see me as the tutor, and I would have no idea, and I'd pick up the phone and call Rosemary, and Rosemary would then guide me step by step through what I should be doing until I learned I knew how to handle these cases. So she was an enormous benefit to that job.
And you've had quite a lot of contact with students because you were involved also in halls and...
That's right. I became the warden at Carsordas Hall and was there for 6.5 years. And that was enormous fun. Life was full of surprises. I remember the bursar calling me down one morning to the main entrance and taking me into the lift. And sometime during the night, somebody had taken the very fine mashed spinach that you can get and smeared it all over one of the lifts. And for no particular reason I could see, there's this green spinachy mirror in our lift. And that, you know, that tended to happen quite a lot. But I really enjoyed it. The spirit there, I was lucky. Castleman's was, when I first moved in, was big because we had the hall and two blocks of flats. But at the end of my first year, the new halls were opening up, and so they decided not to renew the lease, LSE lease on the flats, and we suddenly shrank to being the smallest with only about 180 students. And from then on, it was really enjoyable because with 180 students in a small hall, you can really get to know everybody. And I was very impressed by the care students took looking after each other. We had one student who was diabetic, and he was pretty careful, except when his birthday came. I think he was 21st. And being a 21st birthday, he celebrated, and he forgot about his insulin. And a couple of his friends came dashing up to the warden's flat, said, "We think X has forgotten his insulin." So he got straight on to, it was Camdoc, I think, Camidoc, the after-hours doctor's service, and within 15 minutes a doctor was there and sorted it out. But it was very typical, and if somebody got really drunk, students would make sure they were put in the proper position on their side, pillars propped up so they couldn't roll on their back and, you know, have a problem. And that tended to be very much the ethos. I was really both impressed and, you know, it was a good place. I really enjoyed that experience.
Was there any pastoral care that was involved when you were a tutor or when you were a warden?
More as warden, in fact, because this is perhaps one of the changes one can mention. When I started in October 1960, I was given 6 students to tutor, and we had probably something like Oxbridge tutorials. They would write essays for me. We'd meet 3-4 times a term. By the time I retired in 1992, I had 800 tutees, so I was departmental tutor, and I was responsible for all the students in the department in a general sense. And the final year I was just a regular tutor, I had 35 tutees. And so then it was just a question of signing forms and reading their reports and so on. You know, at 35, you can't tutor. But when I became the warden, although there were 180 people there, because you were seeing them every day, and not just in a class or at a lecture, but you're seeing them, you know, in the kitchen and in the common room, and because there was good feedback, you quickly got to know if there was somebody with a problem and whether it was the kind of problem you could go and talk to them about, or get their friends to, you know, suggest they might come and talk to you. One good thing about Carl Saunders was, in addition to me as warden, we had a couple of sub-wardens who were postgrads. And they were enormously useful because, being postgrads, they were in that joint role. They were sub-wardens, so they held authority, but they were also students, and therefore they had some of the same problems and you know, bitches that everybody did. And so I got an enormous amount of feedback from the sub-wardens, which was often very helpful.
Did you find it was difficult at the time to balance your sort of pastoral care of students and the teaching of students with any of your ambitions in research?
No, because I became warden about 2 years before I retired. Okay. And went on after retirement. I became a part-time member of the department, just teaching a couple of courses I wanted to keep. And I continued as departmental tutor. But by that point, I'd more or less completed what I would do as a full-time academic. In fact, I have gone on doing research since, and I've completed several pieces of research since then, some publications. But the pressure was off by that time, and I didn't need to publish. I'd already got as far as I could as an academic. I was a reader, and I knew I wasn't going to become a full professor because the kind of research I was doing wouldn't lead to that kind of breakthrough or originality. And so I could, you know, I could continue because I was interested in what I was doing, but I didn't have the pressure on me to publish or perish.
And how do you feel that the campus has changed in your time that you've been here?
Well, some obvious changes. It's a lot bigger. We've moved from just Houghton Street to the new academic building, Lincoln's Inn Field, buildings around the corner on Kingsway and so on. So it's much more spread out than it was. And a lot of the buildings are, you know, the general campus has improved enormously in the quality of the buildings. I mean, as I said earlier, it was a slum originally, you know, decrepit buildings, taxis roaring up Houghton Street. So it's a much pleasanter base. That's offset slightly by the expansion of numbers. And so, you know, some measure of space per capita, we probably haven't changed all that much because while we've got more buildings, we've got more people in. But I think it's much more attractive. And some of the new buildings, I think, have been splendid. I think the new academic building and the new students' building are both splendid new buildings. I think they've done a very good job in this building, Lincoln's Inn Field building, And what eventually will come on Houghton Street when they've knocked down and rebuilt there, I think, will be pretty splendid too. So, you know, it's certainly changing for the better.
You mentioned that space and buildings was one of the challenges. What were, like, the other challenges of working at LSE? What were the things that you weren't so fond of?
Well, I think you sort of see them in hindsight almost. The fact that we didn't have photocopying, so that meant handwriting an awful lot more, whereas now I would photocopy an article and use a highlighter. Then I would go through, read the article and make notes on it. Whereas, you know, now it takes me maybe 10 minutes or 5 minutes to photocopy, 10, 15 minutes to read and mark up. Then it might take me a whole morning to read an article and make proper notes on it. We didn't have photocopying possibilities, which meant another thing, which is we couldn't mass produce handouts with a photocopier. What we had to think was a thing called a Gestetner machine. What happened was that a typist would type a stencil that without having a ribbon in the typewriter. So the keys would cut letter shapes in this wax stencil. The stencil would then be placed over an inky drum and paper would be fed through. And as it went through, the drum would squeeze ink through these letters cut in the stencil and make copies. Well, the general quality was obviously pretty horrible because, you know, depending on how you hit the keys, you either get a very good or not. It got better with electric typewriters.
That doesn't sound very sustainable.
Well, you could keep the stencils. They were horrible, messy things, but people used to keep them. And then the following year, the secretaries would curse when they had to pull out these inky wax things and put them on a drum and make further handouts. But the technical things like that have made an enormous difference. Even in recent times, when I was departmental tutor and then dean of undergraduate studies, I'd often want to take work at home. Now, by now, we had computers, but we didn't have gigabyte memory sticks. What we had were, first of all, 5 1/4-inch floppy disks, which had a capacity of, I've forgotten now, I think 700 kilobytes or something like that. Then we went up 3 1/2-inch disks, which the full ones would take 1.7 megabytes. And so I would go home with material on disk, and I would take a box of 10 of these 3 1/2-inch disks with files on students and other things like that to work on. Whereas now they'd all go on a memory stick and leave, you know, 90% of it still free. So all those things, even in recent times, have made an enormous difference. And digitization now has made the library so much different. Quite recently, I went looking for, on the catalogue, looking for a journal, and I found the old issues had all gone. But then I talked to the librarian and said, well, just go, you know, go online and put in the year of the journal. Shows how out of touch I am. And then I did, and of course, within 10 minutes, I was printing off the article, simply because it's all there online now. So, you know, those kind of things made an enormous difference.
Did you get involved in any sort of staff activities while you were at LSE? Did you get involved, like, with the senior common room or any sort of staff organisations or unions or groups?
Well, I was in the union. It was really called the AUT, AUT, the Association of University Teachers. And then later, when higher education expanded, it then changed to be UCU, the University and College Union. Sorry, Universities and College Union, which is now what I'm... I've always been a member of the union, both AUT and now UCU. I was involved in the common room quite early on. I was asked to be the secretary, and I accepted with great enthusiasm because it was a way of meeting people outside the economics department.
So around about what time was this?
This was about 1961, too, I think it was, the year after I came on the staff. And as a sign of how things have changed, we had a real problem in the senior common room the year I was secretary, because one of our alumni had come back from Chicago. Where he got a first at LSE, gone to Chicago, and was doing a PhD there, incredibly bright guy. He came back, and he was married, and his wife enrolled as a student here. And so the problem for the common room was normally visitors, wives are invited to be honorary members of the common room. On the islands, a ban on students. So what do you do? And there was a real conflict in the department with the older staff members on the whole wanting to apply the student rule and say, well, while we'd like her to be a member, while she's a student here, she can't be a member. And the young members saying, well, come on, you know, she's the member, she's the wife of a member of our common room. And when it came to the vote, she was allowed in. But by the time she was so fed up with it, she declined to come in. And that was obviously a sensible thing to do. But it gives you an idea of the kind of student staff ideas at that time. There was a real difference.
Do you think student staff relations have changed from then until when you retired?
Oh, yes, now? Yeah. The big change came after the troubles in the late 60s. Because it became quite clear then that you couldn't treat these students as kids. That they were adults, and you had to treat them that way. And the kind of doom and gloom that some academics thought would come about if you let students onto committees turned out to be totally unfounded. One example: we had these committees soon after all the troubles got sorted out. Students came onto most of the committees. And there was a big sense there might be problems when we were going to put the fees up for the first time. And given that we'd had all these problems earlier, there was really a lot of concern before making the decision that that could be a real problem. Anyway, we went to the committees, and one of the postgrads, a Brazilian, who will probably go on to be president of that country at one stage, he's so good at diplomacy, he came up with a solution, which was go ahead and raise the fees, but take a proportion of the extra money and turn that into bursaries for students. I mean, I think the general philosophy was students didn't mind rich students paying extra fees. What they were concerned about was that if it was a general rise, then the poorer students might not be able to come. So if you raised the fees and the rich people paid it, but you then use some of that money to provide scholarships and bursaries for students who needed it, then that was a good compromise. And that's what happened. And that's been the pattern since. If fees go up, you tend to find, on the whole, the LSE support for students goes up.
In grants or in prizes or
That's one of the things I was on lots of committees, and one of the committees I was on was the student support committee, and that was involved with giving support to, I was on the postgraduate side. This was back in the 1970s to 80s, and some nice things happened there. One was we got a request from a part-time student trying to finish off a PhD. And he, in fact, had fought in the Spanish Civil War and was trying to finish writing a PhD on the politics of the Civil War. And we gave him a grant of, I think, £500 to finish off his PhD, which was then published. And that was a wonderful sense of continuity with the past. The other thing that happened was an improvement for postgraduates, because one of the three members on that panel, a professor, became very angry when he looked at certain reports on postgraduates. You know, there would be the report of a postgraduate applying for help, often overseas student. And the first year, the tutor would say at the end of it that X is reading the literature and making progress. Go to the end of the second year, short report, X is reading the literature and making progress. And now X was in his third year and really obviously had not had proper support and was running out of money and needed help. And this professor was so angry that he helped to institute a system whereby you didn't just have one supervisor, you had two or three. and therefore this sort of thing couldn't happen, that a shy overseas student would have a supervisor who wasn't really supporting him, but not feel he could raise it because of his position. Whereas now with three people on it, you know, that can't happen. That was a big, that came through the, that work, or at least it started in that commission. How are we doing on time?
Oh, we've got lots of time, actually.
Fine, okay.
You can take a break if you want, though.
No, that's fine. I don't want to burble on too long.
No, no, it's interesting. So, how do you feel that the... So you're in the economics department. How do you feel the economics department has changed over the years? Or compared to what it was when you first started?
Well, it's become like... departments everywhere, it's become much more technical. And I came into the department in 1960, and the at that point there was very little teaching of mathematics or statistics in the department. And that continued for about the first 3 years or so. The only exception was Bill Phillips, who... had been on the staff for some time. But then gradually we began to appoint people who were much more technically, more technical as economists. We got Frank Hahn, Terence Gorman, Harry Johnson, a whole range of people who were all much more interested in that kind of theory. And also we brought in teaching of econometrics and so on. So it changed very markedly over time, and now it's, you know, very much a technical department.
And did you enjoy working with your colleagues? I mean, did you find that, as well as working with the academic staff, did you also enjoy working with the administrative staff as well?
Very much so. I mean, we've been lucky, really, to, with our admin staff, I think, we've... I think initially the librarian when I first started was somewhat crotchety, and I think he didn't like students. They took books off the shelves and put finger marks on them and so on. But once he left, since then, I think the library staff, well, the junior staff, they're always very helpful and so on. But even, the, you know, higher up the library, I've always found they've been very helpful and very pro academics and students. The administration I've always found very helpful and very pro-student. They're often, you know, really, but not use the word, fed up with the academics who don't get things in on time, and, you know, even with deadlines, they tend to be a bit sloppy. So I sympathised and did what I could to chase my colleagues up once I was departmental tutor or the undergraduate tutor. But no, we've been lucky. I think we've had high... quality supervisors in the graduate office, the registry. They were good in the halls. So I've been impressed. I think they've been good.
And what made you decide to to become a visiting professor for these other institutions? What made you decide to try new experiences abroad?
Very much the chance to travel. The first one was to go to Greece, and that was great fun. You know, I'd been to Europe, but I hadn't done a great deal of travelling. At school, we couldn't afford it. And then, the Air Force, I went to Germany and fought the Americans as part of a NATO exercise, were lost. But apart from that, and travelling a bit around Britain, when I started as a student, obviously, I'd really not travelled that much either in the UK, except when I'd gone to various RAF camps. My parents came from Wales, so I, you know, went to visit my family in Wales. And I made a couple of trips to Europe. But that was it. So, when I suddenly went from being an impecunious student to being a not very well-paid academic, my first year salary, when I started teaching as an assistant lecturer in 1960, was £500 before tax.
Per year?
Per year, yeah. Mind you, prices... were also lower. I came across a copy of the Good Food Guide for London the other day from about that time, and at a top-class restaurant, a bottle of wine was 12 and sixpence. So it gives you an idea of £500 salary, but wine 12 and sixpence as opposed to £20. But I hadn't travelled that much, so when a Greek colleague said, would you like to go out to Athens to research at the Centre for Economic Research, I said yes, and went off and had a great time. And I'd also got to know an American visitor that year from Columbia University in New York, and I talked to him a bit about visiting. And he managed to get me an invitation to go and teach summer session there. So I had 3 years going out in July, August, and teaching summer session courses at Columbia University, which was very hard work, but meant I was in New York. I could travel down to Washington and Boston. And at that time, I had a girlfriend who was from California. And so I flew out to Berkeley and spent some time out in California. And that was good.
What was it like being in America in the 60s?
Well, the contrast in wealth was enormous and the quality of living, because rationing had stopped in 53 and things were getting better. But certainly there was nothing like the affluence that you could see once you got to America. Prices in comparison were much, much lower. And even as a summer session teacher, I got very well paid. And so I had a great time. I flew around the States. They had these non-scheduled airlines, which are very much like the cheap ones here now, and you could fly to California for not that much. So, yeah, that was great. In fact, I came back at the end of 3 years and really felt I'd like to go to the States. And so I registered for a PhD here, since although I didn't need one here as a teacher, I would need one in the United States. And registered, although then I found, you know, the actual finding time to do anything and finding a proper topic never quite happened. And so I never went back and I never got my PhD. But then quite late on in the 1980s, I actually got a link with Latin America and began to get invited by Peru, Colombia, Brazil, to go out and do some teaching for the British Council. And that again opened up possibility of travel. The British Council would pay my fares, the university would pay for my subsistence, and I would pay the other expenses. But given I was getting, you know, a trip to Latin America, and once the teaching was over, I could then play tourist and, you know, go travel. It was great. And I had a couple of great trips. I ended up going to Chile for my last few trips. I went to Santiago and did teaching and research there. And on one of the occasions, my partner came out and joined me in Santiago, and we travelled by train, plane, and car all the way down to Tierra del Fuego, right at, you know, in the south. And then the following year, she came out again, and we hired a Hertz car in Santiago and drove up the Pan American Highway all the way to the Peruvian border.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, and that was why I enjoyed the teaching in Latin America, the fact I could see Latin America.
So in terms of actually being at LSE and all the work that you've done at LSE, what are the things you're most proud of, like what are your highlights?
Well, probably these are boring. There were a couple of research breakthroughs which I look back as being successful. One was a very technical thing dealing with serial adjustment in statistical analysis, and suggesting that if one thought of it as an autoregressive process of order four, you could actually deal with it. And that was picked up and changed the way certain research was done. And the other one was to develop the area of informal economic analysis, all those areas of economics which are not recorded in the national income accounts, like household activity. Women's work never gets included in the national accounts. The informal activity that goes on in developing countries, people selling in the streets, small enterprises that are not registered, and then the black economy, all the work that is legal but is hidden from the tax man, and then finally crime. And I wrote a book that tried to estimate the value of that in national income terms, and that got picked up by a number of people and You know, it's not an active field, but people periodically do things on the informal sector or the black economy.
So it's like quite big, too big, very personal. Like,
well, they were personal achievements. They were interesting to do and to see people pick them up. Then I more personally, I certainly enjoyed the time at Carl Saunders and the interaction with students there. And I think there were a few students I did manage to help in a major way when they were having problems and needed somebody to talk to or some advice on you know, how to get help.
What do you think will be the future of LSE?
I think it'll be very positive. I think academically these standards have been maintained. We've expanded into all sorts of new areas. And going back again to the post-Thatcher problem, when we suddenly had to start attracting overseas students, one of the ways that was done without dropping standards was to use the fact that we are a school of social sciences, and there are lots of overlaps. And so what we were able to do was to put together master's programs which brought together the overlaps. And so you could see that gender was being taught here, 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 and here. So if you were to set up a gender institute, bring in a specific course on gender, and then use the gender taught in sociology, you suddenly had a new master's program, and a very popular one. Then you can open up a development studies institute. And suddenly you find development and gender overlaps. And so you have a joint master's in development gender. And that was what happened all the way through the school. So you maintain standards because you're not teaching the same course but having to drop standards to get more students. You're attracting new students and you can set the same standard.
You're not diluting it.
That's right. Yeah. And I think LSE will go on doing that because we've got lots of areas which are developing. And we've got new institutes opening already. Strong links with China. Now, I think sustainability, the work that Nick Stern is doing, for example, and lots of areas like that where new problems come up, we've got people working around the fringe or directly in them, and so therefore you can begin to expand in those areas. Once you're doing research in the area, you can usually then start teaching in that area. Either academic subjects for students who are coming in directly, or you can arrange students for professionals, as was done very successfully in development. There's a lot of controversy when we were going to develop some courses on management. There was a lot of suspicion that what we didn't want was to have a kind of Mickey Mouse course where you had a bit of accounting, a bit of this, a bit of that, and call it management. It had to be serious. And when the argument for it was put to the academic board, it was very much in teaching management for development, for example. What do NGOs need to run properly? And that sold the idea. Yes, this is not going to be Mickey Mouse, you know, accounting and a bit of psychology of business. This is going to be serious courses. And it's been a very successful course. And I think LSE got a lot of scope in that kind of area, where we can lay on a serious academic course, but attract people from government or areas like that, you know, who need it for professional development, and where the government will be prepared to send them to do the course. And I think that's one area I think we'll develop.
I think that's probably one of the most successful departments now.
Mm. But certainly when they came to sell the case, we were, you know, a lot of people were suspicious. We just don't want, you know, they got the business school doing proper business and other places were doing what we thought were Mickey Mouse courses, which weren't serious. And so we didn't want to be in that category. But once they made the case out and you could see exactly what they planned and the kind of quality it would be, it was very enthusiastic.
What do you think of the rise in tuition fees?
I think it's very bad. I think, well, let's go back. Well, I think the idea of expanding higher education was admirable. I'm 100% behind it. What I think was a mistake, though, was to make it target entirely on degrees. Because I think what that resulted in was an overly rapid expansion in the university and college sector, with the need to provide courses for people who didn't necessarily ideally want to do an academic course, and a tremendous loss in the development of technical education. Any assessment of where we are on the, you know, the ladder of technical competence shows we have an enormous deficit compared with Germany, France, and other European countries where they have proper technical education. We've kind of choked that off. The result has been, I think, that a lot of institutions are teaching degrees which don't really have any purpose. But because they were able to expand and what they put in was accepted, that was a mistake, I think. And now the result is that the students in those courses are paying high fees and getting into debt. And often the courses they are doing, I mean, this is just a personal opinion, don't really pay off. Whereas many of them, I think, if the status had been there and the respect, would have been able to go in proper high-level technical training. And the UK would have been better off because we wouldn't find we're having to bring in from abroad properly qualified technical people. So I think, I don't think fees should be at the levels they are, and I think we messed things up at the beginning by not going for higher education as opposed to university expansion.
So in light of everything we've just said, do you feel like there's something I haven't covered that you'd like to talk about, or anything you'd want to say? Or anything that you've... any stories that you want to tell that you feel like we haven't touched upon?
Well, I think overall, the LSE has made progress in lots and lots of areas. I think teaching is much, much better than it was. That has come partly internally, and they're not... these various government surveys also tend to make things better, though I think the waste of resources that goes into preparing for them is awful. I went to a seminar given by somebody in the council department, and since I retired, there are now apparently government inspections where you have to say how much impact your research has. And that sounded like a real dog's body, a dog's breakfast, that you had to specify research you'd done and then outline what impact that had had on the outside world and then bring in support for it. People would say, my life has changed because Jim Thomas wrote this article on whatever. I sat in that seminar thinking, I'm so glad I retired and I didn't have all this rubbish to worry about. But, you know, that's the kind of thing which is the downside. But I think there's no doubt teaching is better, the facilities are much better. Technically, the progress, I mean, just general progress, not just in the university, has made an enormous difference. Digitalization, the enormous difference that makes to teaching. So, you know, I'm very glad to have seen all these developments. I think I can't say much about students, though, because obviously, as a retired researcher, I see students around, but I don't really have much interaction with them. Some postgrads I go to seminars regularly with, I get to know a bit, but I don't have any contact with undergraduates or most taught students. So I only know a bit about how they feel about things, rather than having real contact.
Yeah, I think it can be quite varied, people's feelings about
it. I mean, another big change, of course, is the big increase in both postgraduates and overseas students. They've changed. I mean, when I first started teaching, the undergraduates were the bulk of the students here. There were very few PhD students. They were poor, lonely souls who were working under a supervisor on their own subject. The master's degree at that time was also by thesis and exam. And the master's then were really for students who weren't good enough to do a PhD. So they might start on a PhD program, weren't going to be good enough, so they'd be put on the master's. They'd then write a lower level thesis, do an exam on their subject, and get the MSc. Then the taught masters came in, and that meant now that you had students doing the same courses, a great deal more sense of group together. And then the big change came when the PhD was changed, and so they became more like the American system, where you had to do coursework at the beginning of your PhD. And now you had students coming in on a PhD all doing courses together. And that made an enormous difference. Instead of having a lonely PhD student working on his own, dependent on his one supervisor in the bad old days, and really often getting very depressed and having nowhere to go. Now you had a group of 30, 40 people coming in together, starting on a program, going to lectures and seminars, and staying together than they're doing their PhDs. So I think, life for students in some ways is better. There's a lot more support, both from the school and the support you get from being part of a group.
There has probably also been an element, a slight difficulty with technology now, in the sense that there's a lot more information out there. I imagine when you first started teaching, there was less information on certain subjects. There were obviously books that you could study and you could read. But now, at the drop of a hat, you can look up anything on the internet.
Yes.
How do you think that's impacted how people study?
I think it's good in the sense that it can open up areas you might not have thought about. I find often now, if I'm starting on a research project, I will Google some key words or key expressions, and it'll begin to bring up links, some of them useful, some of them not. And often we'll download Google articles, but then what I tend to look at are the references and follow things up there. But I think the only thing would be you can't rely on Google. If Google is all you use, then occasionally you'll end up with some awful results, because possibly somebody writes a Google entry that they're not qualified to do, or somebody is malicious and gets in there and changes it, and you end up with garbage. But I'm very much pro-Google, and as long as you don't rely on it. But as a way of getting into an area and finding out what you should follow up, I find it very useful, and I use it a lot.
Was there anything else you'd like to add?
I can't think of anything at the moment. We talked about my student experience and staff experience. We talked about Carl Saunders. And
if there's anything else you ever want to add as well, if you want to add it at a later date, I can always come and interview you again as well. You don't have to do this just once, you can do it more than once if you want. Go ahead.
There's one thing I forgot about when I first started teaching here. I moved from being an undergraduate doing maths and stats to assistant lecturer in economics, teaching economics. And I started in the beginning of October 1960. And I think it was at the end of October, I was asked if I'd help supervise an MSc student with Professor Roy Allen as the main supervisor. And they assured me he'd do all the work, and I'd simply be there as a name on the paper. Unfortunately, in December 1960, he pulled out. And they were going to get a replacement for him, and they never did. And I was an undergraduate supervising an overseas student doing a master's degree, and it was very embarrassing because the student would ask me how he was doing and was he doing okay. And as an undergraduate, I had really no idea, and I was just so sort of new to being academic, and I didn't feel I had the confidence to say to the authorities, "Hey, this is stupid." Anyway, he got his master's and went on to become a professor at a top English university, so he survived it, but it was a very miserable experience for both of us.